Although there are many grand figures to be described when you bring Roman history to your class, it's important to spend a little bit of time with Aeneas. As I said earlier, you might just want to read excerpts from the Aeneid to your class during lunchtime. I found even in sixth grade and to some degree in seventh grade, spending 10 or 15 minutes while the students are quietly eating, telling them, reading to them from some good classical literature, never did any harm, and they really appreciated it. So that's one way of preparing them. The Aeneid is not read very much in our time. It certainly has been overshadowed by the far more popular Homeric epics of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And we tend to forget that for, 1,000 years or so, Virgil was called the poet with a capital P by Europeans. It was his version of the story of the conquest of Rome that dominated. The Homeric stories were hardly known. Not until the time of the Renaissance did the Greek version get known, in the same way that Aristotle was the philosopher rather than Plato. So for that reason, on a cultural level, Virgil himself is a bridge to the Middle Ages from Rome, and Dante certainly sees him in that way when he makes Virgil his guide into the world of Inferno and Purgatorio in his Divine Comedy, which you may want to read or allude to some degree, with your students later this year. We also have in the figure of Aeneas one who is carrying something over from Troy. And Steiner tells us that the difference between Greece and Troy was that the Trojans carried very strongly traces of the atavistic clairvoyance, that they were far more connected to the old gods via direct vision, while the Greeks were losing this vision. So Odysseus, the crafty Odysseus, as he's called again and again in the Odyssey, creates the Trojan horse and is able to deceive the Trojans because they're not seeing the world in the same way. Odysseus is one who's losing the clairvoyance, who often doesn't realize it when Hermes or Athena is standing right in front of him giving advice, whereas Aeneas is still more in touch with that vital nerve. But it's something old, it's something that's meant to die away, and Aeneas must bring something of it with him. So we see, for example, symbolically how he carries his father Anchises, the husband of Venus, on his back. He loses his wife in the melee of the pillage of Troy, but his father carries the sacred images of the household gods with them. So that is going to be brought to the new land. And he's able to escape. Father, son, and grandson are able to leave Troy because they're under the protection of Aeneas' mother, Venus, who was never a friend of the Greeks, far more in favor of a Trojan victory. She rescues them, and Aeneas and his followers are then able to build themselves boats and leave. They stop on the island of Delos, and there they are given the oracular prophecy that if they go back to the home of the Trojans, the mother of the Trojans, which means the Italian peninsula, there they will found a great new kingdom that will live on for long. And along the journey, they're very close in Sicily, rounding the boot. When Anchises dies, Aeneas stops to give his father a proper funeral, and Juno, Hera to the Greeks, the wife of Jupiter or Zeus, is jealous and hateful of Aeneas because of his connection to Venus. So she causes a great storm to occur, much in the way that Poseidon again and again tried to hinder Odysseus from reaching his goal. And this leads Aeneas to northern Africa, where he consorts for a period of time with Dido, the queen of Carthage, which is itself at this time a small town. In later years, Dido's land of Carthage and Aeneas's land of Rome will be bitter enemies. And this is because rather than remaining with Dido, who falls deeply in love with him, Aeneas is told by a messenger of Jupiter that he must go on and fulfill his destiny, leave northern Africa, and find his way to the shores of Italy, which he does. He there marries the daughter of the great king of the Latium people, and she in turn then leads him to the place that he is to start a new city, Alba Longa, the great long white city. So in this way then, we see Aeneas taking the household gods of Troy, taking this old clairvoyant faculty, and bringing it now to a very new setting. Now 650, 700 years or so pass, and we begin with the story of Romulus and Remus and the actual founding of Rome. So let me just tell it to you as I would tell it to my class, just to get a feeling for how one begins to bring this sort of thing to the sixth grade. So Romulus and Remus were two boys who were descended directly from Aeneas, and their father was Mars, also known as Ares to the Greeks, the god of war. Their grandfather was Numitor, and he was the king of Alba Longa. Now there was a legend, a prophecy, that Numitor's daughter would give birth to one who would be himself a very, very great king and rule for a long period of time, who would begin fulfilling the prophecy that Aeneas had heard when he went to the island of Delos. And so when it was learned that Numitor's daughter was going to be old enough to bear children, a usurper threw Numitor off the throne, took on the kingdom in his stead, and not willing to kill the daughter of Numitor for fear of a popular uprising, made her a Vestal Virgin, so that she would have to keep the flame of Rome, the eternal flame which would guarantee Rome's safety, would always have to be fed fuel and kept lit and tended. And as the term implied, she was not allowed to have any kind of commerce with a man whatsoever. So in this way, she was given an apparent honor, and yet it was also a good way of keeping her from bearing any children. However, she was very beautiful to look upon, and once when she went down to the river to bathe, the god Mars, who was returning from the scene of one or another of his battles, saw her, felt deeply for her, and so it was that less than a year later, she bore him sons, twin boys. However, word got around to the usurper, and he immediately had the boys taken, thrown into a kind of trough, like a little boat, thrown into the river Tiber, with the expectation that its rough waters would simply drown them. However, the river itself was kindly disposed towards these children, and the little trough was cast ashore at the foot of Mount Palatine. And then a kind wolf came by, found them, and nourished the children with her own milk. And meanwhile, a woodpecker, a bird sacred to Mars, would feed them with berries. Now, when we were in fourth grade, does anyone remember anything about a wolf there? Yes, that's right. We learned about wolves in our zoology class, right? Did we learn about them anywhere else? Well, hopefully, even though 2 years have passed, someone will remember the Fenris wolf, who was a very destructive being who was sired by Loki at a time when Loki was in tremendous enmity towards the gods. So there the wolf was something feared. He was chasing the sun and trying to bite away at it. Very different now. Now the wolf is the one who is nurturing the future progenitors of Rome. So we're starting in a very different way. And who is the father of these twin boys? Mars, the god of war. So if we think of the wolf, its hunger, its power, its stamina, and we think of Mars with his love of war and his tremendous boldness and recklessness as a god, quite a potent combination to have as your father and as the one who's nurturing you. Well, they couldn't stay forever with the wolf, and as it happened, Faustulus, a passing shepherd, saw them. And although he was very poor, he took the babies home, and he brought them up as shepherd boys. So they became very strong. They had to fight robbers sometimes who tried to take the sheep. They had to rush towards wild beasts and keep them away from the precious sheep that they were caring for. And only when they became of age, which means that they were about your age, sixth graders, 12, 13, 14 at the most, did they learn of their royal birth. And with that, Romulus and Remus quickly found their way towards their grandfather's usurper, killed him, and they placed their grandfather Numitor again on his throne. And then they decided that they too wished to be kings. They were going to create their own cities. So they went off to a little further along the Tiber, and there they found a beautiful spot with seven hills. And going towards the highest of those hills, they determined that the city would be built. Now, the Romans were way back then, and remain so for many years, always interested in auguries, in looking at things in nature, especially in the animal world, to help them decide what they should do and whether one act or another would be fortuitous or not. And so they looked towards the flight of birds, and they saw that Romulus noticed 12 vultures were flying in one corner of the sky. Remus, his brother, saw only 6. And then Romulus knew that he was going to build the city and that he was going to be famous for 12 centuries. He marked his boundary with a plow, and he built around it a low wall made of mud. This was just to demarcate his city, his plot, from anyone else's. But it also meant that that was the border, that eventually a higher wall would be there, which would keep any enemy from entering the city. Remus, a little bit jealous, perhaps, of his brother seeing the 12 vultures when he saw only 6, and a little bit dismayed at the speed with which his brother was building, jumped over the wall and exclaimed in scorn, "This is what your enemies will do." And he laughed. And Romulus immediately killed his brother. And he said, "So perish all who leap over my walls." Brother against brother. We've heard a story like this before, of course, way back in third grade. But here it's the very beginning of the story of Rome. Twin brothers who fight with one another. And so, dear teachers, speaking to you now, I would say, here is the first of the great polarities of Roman life, Romulus and Remus, twin brothers, one of whom must slay the other. So all of the elements of the drama of Rome are prefigured in this story.